Fleet reads How to Escape in Gaelic.
The Professor of Aeronautical Engineering, or rather the former Professor of Aeronautical Engineering, remembered what his very last postgraduate student said to him on his final day in the department.
Weight of materials, Professor, that's the question, isn't it? Do you think we'll ever crack that one and get battery-powered aircraft?
He had smiled. He'd always liked that young man who had come all the way to Glasgow from... Where had he come from? From Melbourne, wasn't it? Who had come all that way to study with him and to write a doctoral thesis on the strength of wing structures. He had answered the young man with another question.
Does it really matter if aircraft became slower?
The young man had looked at him in astonishment.
But of course it does, he said. We have to go faster. It's all about speed.
It's all about speed. He had repeated the phrase, muttering it under his breath. Was it really all about speed? All about making faster planes that would get you from Europe to Australia in 10 hours, then 8, and then more or less instantly? Did we really need that?
Now, standing in front of the large house on the Hebridean island of Mull, he looked out to the west, to the place from where, as Matron liked to say, our weather came from.
The house was a nursing home, tactfully known as a retirement home, and it was presided over by Matron and her assistant, Nurse, who were both Gaelic speakers. None of the 12 residents spoke Gaelic, although one of them pretended that he did. He would nod in agreement if he heard Matron and Nurse speaking as if he were party to their conversation, but he did not understand. Matron had said as much to Cook, who came from Stornoway, and who was cheerfully robust in her treatment of the residents, for each of whom she had a nickname. The man who claimed to understand Gaelic was called the non-speaker of Gaelic. The retired trawler skipper from Oban was called Captain Puffer, a reference to the old steamers that used to ply their way around the west coast of Scotland, belching smoke. And he himself was called Professor Einstein, which was because they knew he was something to do with complicated engineering. He was not happy in the home. He had come here 12 years after his retirement and after 20 years as a widower, because his daughter had insisted. He had not wanted to leave Glasgow, but she had wanted him to live closer to her. She was a bit further down the coast, and she also felt he would be safer in a home. She had always watched over him. She did not like him to go out, and when he came to visit her, if he took himself off for a walk, she would start fretting about his safety after 10 minutes or so. It was all done with the best of intentions, but he found it very restricting.
"You can't wrap me up in cotton wool," he said. "I've got to live."
"I'm not wrapping you up," she said, "but you have to be careful. At your age, anything could happen."
"But I want something to happen," he protested. "I'd love to have an adventure or two."
"It's a good place for you to be, Dad," she said. "It's comfortable, and you'll have great views. It's right by the sea, and you'll have a great view."
He had complied with her wishes and had hoped that he would, in due course, become used to life in the home. But that had not happened. He did not like Matron, and although she did her best to conceal her feelings, she did not like him. He did not like her bossiness. He did not like the way she insisted that everybody be in bed by 8 at night, even on those long summer evenings when, at that latitude, it barely became dark at all.
"I'd like to stay up longer," he said, "especially on these light evenings, especially then."
Matron shook her head. "You're safer in bed," she said. Nurse, who had been listening, said to Matron, in Gaelic,
"He's a troublemaker, that one. He may have been a professor in Glasgow, but he isn't any more."
"What did she say?" he said.
Matron smiled.
"She just agreed with me, that's all."
"In Glasgow," he said, "it was considered impolite to break into a language that other people don't understand."
"Ah, well," said Matron, "there we are."
One of his former students sent him a magazine subscription. This student, who had done well in the aeronautical industry, thought he might enjoy the magazine Practical Aviation on the editorial board of which he served. "It's a bit of a rag-bag of articles," said the former student, "but there were things in it that might interest you." There were, and in particular there was an article on amateur ballooning that caught his eye. This article was illustrated with photographs of small hot air and gas balloons that various enthusiasts had built in their garages and backyards. At the end of the article was a list of suppliers of various components of such aircraft, with the addresses from which you could order cylinders of helium, ropes, baskets, and all the rest of the paraphernalia required to make a personal balloon. One of the photographs caught his eye. "Freedom for Mr. George Harris of Yorkshire," the caption said. "Up he goes on his maiden flight, which ended safely 30 miles away in the Dales." He studied the picture. Mr. George Harris, crouching in a small wicker basket, could be seen waving to his ground crew below him. Everybody looked happy, especially Mr. George Harris, who was, he assumed, feeling the first flush of that freedom. He set the magazine aside and looked up at the ceiling, sunk deep in thought. A cousin had left him a small legacy, £1,500, and he had not known what to do with it. She had written to him, "I'm making you a little gift in my will. Please use it for something exciting." He'd been unable to think of anything exciting at the time, but now he felt he'd found something of which she would approve. He cut out the article, along with its list of suppliers. That afternoon, he wrote to four of them, attaching a cheque to each letter, and ordering everything that would be needed to construct a small personal balloon, as described in the article, in Practical Aviation. "Please deliver all supplies," he wrote, "to Mr. Ewan MacDonald at the above address." Ewan MacDonald was the gardener, and was an ally. He did not like matron, nor nurse, and was usually happy to obtain contraband for the residents, cheerfully smuggling in bottles of whisky and boxes of chocolates, both of which were strongly disapproved of by the home authorities. If asked, he would almost certainly be willing to allow the balloon supplies to be stored in one of his sheds, and, the professor imagined, would also agree to the balloon being built in such a shed. The following week, Ewan came to see him when he was sitting in the conservatory reading.
"Some stuff's come for you, Professor," he whispered. "Interesting-looking gear. I've put it away in the shed, if you'd care to take a look."
Not everything had arrived, but even so the packages awaiting him were impressive. Two of them, long oblong things, contained gas cylinders, while another, a large floppy package, was clearly the balloon itself. There were no ropes yet, no basket, but he was confident those would arrive in due course.
"What are you building?"
asked Ewan.
"A balloon," he said. "I received a gift of some money, a legacy, actually, and I thought I'd put it to good use."
"That's a wonderful idea," said the gardener.
He paused and then asked,
"But why build a balloon?"
"I feel like making a trip," replied the professor. "Just an outing. Christmas is coming up and people like to have a bit of fun at Christmas. Why shouldn't I?"
Ewan nodded.
"I understand," he said. "Can I lend you a hand?"
"I'd like that," said the professor.
The rest of the supplies arrived over the next few days. Ewan was discreet, and nobody caught sight of the deliveries. The shed was kept locked, and when he and the professor met there, they did so only when they were sure there was nobody to observe them. The construction of the balloon was not complicated. There were various diagrams from the original magazine article, but even if these had not been to hand, they would have been able to work out what to do on first principles. After a week of work, the aircraft appeared to be ready. The hairnet of ropes had been wound around the balloon, the basket had been firmly attached, and the ballast bags had all been filled with sand that Ewan had collected from the nearby beach.
"I hope there'll be enough lift," said the professor. "It looks rather small."
"It'll look much bigger once it's filled with gas," Ewan reassured him. "It'll be as tall as a house by then."
"I hope so. Then here I come."
Ewan looked at him with interest.
"Where exactly are you planning to go, Professor?" The professor shrugged.
"Somewhere over there." He pointed towards Fort William and Speen Bridge. "Maybe a bit further. I'd rather like Perth. I might get as far as Perth."
"Some nice gardens around here," said Ewan. He paused. "And will you come back?" The professor shook his head. "I haven't decided," he said. "Perth is likely to be just the beginning. After that, I might get across to Denmark. If you look at a map, it's a straight line across." "Have you ever been to Copenhagen?"
Ewan shook his head. "I've never even been to Glasgow."
The professor thought for a moment.
"Would you like to come with me? We could go and have Christmas dinner in one of the hotels over there."
Ewan scratched his chin.
"I hadn't thought about it," he said, "but it could be fun."
"Immense fun," said the professor, "as long as we get off the ground." He looked at Ewan. "You don't look too heavy. We should be all right."
"We could put a bit more gas in," said Ewan.
"Precisely," said the professor.
They dragged the balloon out on Christmas Eve. It was a clear winter's day, unseasonably warm, and not a cloud in the sky. Conditions were ideal. A gentle southwesterly blowing in from Col and Tyree would carry them nicely in the desired direction, and the heat of the winter sun would give them extra lift. Now, out on the lawn outside the shed, they attached the rubber gas lines to the cylinders, opened the valves, and watched the balloon slowly billow into shape. As they prepared to embark, from around the corner of the building came the non-speaker of Gaelic.
"What are you two doing?"
he asked suspiciously.
"What does it look like?"
snapped Ewan.
"You're not allowed to have a balloon," said the non-speaker of Gaelic. "Matron says..."
"Oh, do shut up," said the professor. "I'm going to call Matron," said the non-speaker of Gaelic. "I'm going to tell her."
"Too late," said Ewan. "We're going to be gone in a couple of minutes."
"Matron will get you," said the non-speaker of Gaelic.
The professor looked at him with annoyance.
"You'll have to tell her in English," he snapped, "because you know something. I know you can't speak a word of Gaelic. I've always thought that."
The balloon was now fully inflated. It wobbled like a giant jelly, but it was straining at its ropes. There would be more than enough lift. They climbed in.
"Plenty of room," said Ewan. "I think this basket was made for two."
They cast off the restraining rope. For a moment, nothing happened. And then, slowly, the balloon rose, lifting the creaking basket off the ground. They drifted past the home and saw Matron at an open window gesticulating wildly. Ewan shouted something.
"What was that?"
asked the professor.
"Goodbye in Gaelic,"
said Ewan MacDonald.
James Fleet was reading How to Escape in Gaelic, a new short story for Radio 4 by Alexander McCall-Smith. The producer was Kirsten Cameron, and if you've missed any of the earlier stories in the series, don't forget you can catch up with them on the iPlayer radio app. There's a double bill to make you smile coming up after the news, starting with sketches and songs from the comedy tornado known as Terry Alderton.
Who's that?
This Christmas, a sack full of voices from Alistair McGowan.
You're telling me you're a 230-year-old man who invented Luxembourg?
And words to share with great pleasure.
Winnie the Pooh took his head out of the hole and thought for a little.
Well, there must be somebody there because somebody must have said nobody.
Unpack our Christmas offerings.
The youngest of the strangers said they would find their way by the stars. When a child is born, he said, there is one star kindled to light the soul on its journey.
Discover more on the BBC Radio 4 website.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. A manhunt is underway across Europe for a Tunisian man suspected of carrying out Monday's lorry attack on a Christmas market in Berlin, in which 12 people died. The German authorities are offering a €100,000 reward for information leading to the capture of Anis Amri. It's reported that he'd been under surveillance earlier this year, but the monitoring of him was lifted because of a lack of evidence. A millionaire businessman has been jailed for life for murdering a sex worker he was paying up to £10,000 a month. Peter Morgan strangled Georgina Simmons in her bungalow in Newport in South Wales after learning she was planning to blackmail him. Speaking outside Newport Crown Court, where Morgan was sentenced, Detective Inspector Ian Bartholomew from Gwent Police read this statement.
The actions of Peter Morgan were calculated and he committed the act without emotion. Hopefully this conviction will bring some closure to the family in terms of the criminal justice process. But we are in no doubt that Georgina's family and friends will continue to mourn and grieve for the rest of their lives. Our condolences remain with those who have suffered her loss.
The Labour MP, Jamie Reid, who's been a persistent critic of Jeremy Corbyn, has announced he's standing down to take up a job in the nuclear industry. It's thought the resulting by-election will be difficult for the party, as Mr Reid only narrowly won his Cumbrian seat of Copeland from the Conservatives in 2015. A former Royal Marine who's serving life for murdering an injured Afghan fighter has been refused bail ahead of his appeal next year. Alexander Blackman was jailed after footage from a helmet-mounted camera emerged showing him shooting the combatant at point-blank range in Helmand province in 2011. The Queen and Prince Philip have delayed travelling to Sandringham because they're both suffering from what Buckingham Palace has described as heavy colds. They had been due to catch a train to the estate in Norfolk to join other members of the royal family for Christmas. BBC News.